Hello and welcome to recording number 33 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated recording. Today is July 13th, 2021. All right, I'm going to restart. The story so far is Gord has been rescued by Geller, and they've left Castle Blemmo. Met up with the Gnome King in the Flinty Hills, and now they are headed, they've just reached Inspa. So I'm going to start here. It is page 251, paragraph 2. Although Gord found one or two of the many sorts of waters offered for drinking to be flavorful or refreshing, he had no interest in mineral bath immersions, geysering showers, steaming, coating with mud, or any other such activities. His experience with clericism, such as it was, made him shun the places of devotion and worship. All in all, he was very anxious to move on, just as he had been with the gnomes a fortnight before. Fortunately for Gord, Inspa was located just within the edge of the westernmost fringe of the Adrae. They were so close to their destination that he suspected they would push on soon. Geller had a few calls to make in the town, some information to gather, but after a day to rest their coursers and allow them the luxury of a stall and grain, the two were pushing into the depths of the timberland. So we get a very brief description of Inspa there, but there is some information. We had been told that there were, in the last paragraph, that there were a number of hostels, taverns, and inn, more than Gord had seen before, and also we're shown here how we're told there's 50 religious buildings, from shrines to large temples and great cathedrals, and finally that all the various drinking water, mineral bath, immersions, geysering showers, steaming, coating with mud. It sounds like it really is a spa. And then finally, we've got a little bit here about how Gord how Gord looks at clerical devotion. That Gord does not seem to have any kind of deity he follows. Even with the great amounts of various deities here, there doesn't seem to be so far that Gord's following. All right. And the final thing is that Inspa is just located within the edge of the Adrae Forest. There is a map up here on the Grey Alt Fiction channel, and it shows Inspa, but it all looks green to me. So there might be some delineation here between what the Adrae Forest is and what Inspa, the city is. But it looks like it is really within the Adrae Forest already, although there is a clear area around the city itself.
Yeah, it looks pretty much within the forest to me.
Yeah, it just looks like it goes from the Flinty Hills and then with very little open land directly into the forest. It is a overview, and although this is a smaller scale map than the Darlene map that came with the folio and the 83 box set, it does show a large city and very little in what would be farmland directly around it. That wouldn't be very much room for a large city. It is near the Harp River on this map, and there are several roads, so I guess you could have supplies being brought in either by into a nearby area. Again, it doesn't look like there's a great deal of cleared area around InSpa itself.
I guess all the thermal activity around there is maybe one of the reasons that it's such a religious center.
And, you know, it could also be that there's different kinds of foodstuffs there. I would think that the gnomes must be good at raising fungi, mushrooms and various other kinds of fungi. And there's a question here that InSpa is a religious center. Yes, it according to Gygax, there's pilgrimages to InSpa. And there are 50 or more religious shrines and temples there, from great cathedrals to large temples. So InSpa is actually, in Gygax's version here, a religious center where there are pilgrimage. And earlier on, it was mentioned that Gord and Evely in their escape hid among pilgrims heading toward InSpa, when they did not want to be noticed. And, you know, it's noted here that the Almer is a prelacy, which is, you know, a religious state. InSpa, we find out in this Gygax story so much little things that may or may not be mentioned anywhere else. For instance, yesterday, it was spelled out in the book that the name InSpa is very literal. It is known, it has a tremendous amount of inns and hostels, and the center there is a actual spa with, the waters like our earthly here, our real world lords. And so it is very interesting. There should be, I would think then that there'd probably be healing waters, or like Bath in England. That is very interesting, that Bath, the town or city is, also a place for, I guess, healing waters. But I'm not really familiar with Bath except by name. I don't know really any details about the English Bath, town of Bath.
Yeah, we talked about the waters of lords or lords yesterday.
Yeah, and so I guess there's also an English healing area. I think that there should be some kinds of healing or miraculous waters in InSpa. All right, I'm going to continue here. It is page 251. And it is, I'm going to restart with paragraph 4. The trees grew thickly over the last folds of the flinties here. His companion told Gord that soon the forest floor would become level. It soon turned out to be nearly 3 days, but then the terrain proved to be as promised. In the heart of the woodland, the trees were all towering giants. Interlaced branches far above their heads, and dead leaves under their feet made travel easy, since little underbrush could grow under such conditions. Geller spent quite a bit of time pointing out different types of trees and animal signs to the city-bred young thief. Gord knew most of the common trees, oak, maple, ip, and chestnut, for instance. Thornwood and ash were not so familiar to him. The roan woods and great yews amazed him. He had heard of the yarpick tree, but never seen one, and its long and deadly thorns likewise fascinated him. When the two wayfarers came across such a tree growing at the verge of a rocky meadow within the forest. Break. Well, here we have a very good listing of various trees, either a real world or fantasy. The yarpick is unique to Greyhawk, as I believe the hornwood is I'm not sure about the IP, the IPP tree, but we are now also, oh.
The IP is unique to the planet.
All right, cool. But, you know, we're also given here some information about the different types of trees that are, you know, real world, such as oak, maple, chestnut, roan wood. I think yews are definitely, but I'm not sure about roan wood, if they're a greyhawk tree or not. Definitely the yarpick is. And so we have a little information about the ground, that here the terrain isn't level for 3 days travel. Now, we have, you know, this information here that the trees are very tall with branches overhead. And I don't know if Gygax got this idea from Lord of the Rings and Mirkwood. But yes, you know, if you have this heavily forested area, it will kill off most of the other plant life beneath it because there's just not enough sunlight getting through the, you know, the foliation up top. And it does make it easier for them to ride their horses through if most of the branch, if there's very little, you know, underbrush, and if most of the branches are high over their heads, then you can do that. Now, earlier on, when Gord was fleeing the Pale, he was pursued by horsemen, and it seemed very unlikely that even though they seemed to have a track on him due to a religious item Gord had stolen, it seemed unlikely that they would have been, armored men would have been able to ride their horses through a forest, a regular forest at night, where there is underbrush and where there, you know, there are lower branches ready to knock a rider off his horse or to even block it for the horse itself. So here we have, after 3 days travel, the ground is leveling off and the trees become very high and thick, and so it's easier travel. And here we have now Gord is being instructed by Geller about tree and animal signs. So if you're running a campaign or if you're playing in a campaign, it's good to, you know, as you go along, note in your background what kinds of things you're being informed about. Because your character should always be learning. And it's one of the reasons why I don't like a skill system that only has so many slots. I just think that people learn, and they can learn quite a few different things, you know, within a short period of time. So the skill system locks in things, and it provides ideas. But I think the next step is simply to use role-playing instead of a, like, point system for these things, so that your character learns how to handle a boat, like Gord did with Renee. Your character learns how to tumble and juggle, like Gord did with Renee Atloy. You know, Gord was learning. He learned things like history and geography from Prosper, and then 2 years at Gray College. And so, you know, he paid to learn from a weapons master. So Gord is continually picking up all these various skills and knowledge. And, you know, it isn't just, I think, limited in a way that you get with a point-based skill system. So it's not my favorite kind of thing. And I think if you're a DM, you should really encourage your players to keep a running background going. You know, not just write up one to start, but to keep one going that is, you know, showing what the character has experienced and learned. Back in the 70s, they came out with a campaign journal. And I always liked getting the ones that were filled out because you'd read about somebody's campaign or you'd read about somebody's player experiencing these campaigns. And I love that stuff. And, it, you know, back when I was doing my Hall of the Mountain King website, the cover illustration is right from that campaign journal from the 70s. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 251, the final paragraph. Gord was also treated to his first sight of the gigantically antlered deer that roamed the Adri. He and Geller remained still when they encountered a herd of about a dozen such animals, and the beasts neither charged nor immediately fled. After the herd did bound away, Geller said that the game within the woodland was plentiful. All sorts of bears, wild boars and sows, elk, deer, wolves, lions, and smaller cats too, aurochs and herds of wild cattle, plus the usual variety of smaller sort of game. Although the wood folk who lived within the Adri forest hunted frequently and with much success, they never took more than they needed. Further, Geller explained their foresting of certain of the trees was done to provide grassy clearings for grazing and allow new growth as well. This seemed a quite intelligent and civilized way of life to the young thief. But this knowledge in no way prepared him for his first meeting with the forest dwellers, which came almost immediately thereafter. Break. All right, well, again, like first Geller instructs him in, about the trees and the plants, the flora, and now we get a listing of the various fauna that we can, you know, that is going to be found. Now, all of this outside of the aurochs, which is an actual type of earthly, you know, version, usually an aurochs bull, that we, you know, we do get these thing about the giant antlered deer. And that, I think, is something that really is like a monster manual kind of creature. I don't know. I almost remember a write-up on it, but I may be mistaken. And then we get, you know, the listing of a real-world kind of creatures that are in the Adri. And finally, a little description of the woods folk that are living in the forest and are really a part of the forest and knowing what to do as far as tending to the forest and making allowances for growth and fields for grazing, which explains why in a dense forest like it's supposed to be in this area that you would have room for herds and various creatures that are going to need to have grass and brush and bushes that they can feed on. Especially since the trees are supposed to be very high branched, so that there'd be very little for a lot of these kinds of non-predators to eat. All right.
It's interesting that Geller has so much wood lore and knowledge of woodcraft, but I guess as a first edition bard, he's also a druid first, I think.
Yes, you know, I hadn't even really thought of that, but yeah, I believe he does have druidical training. Now, I don't know if it's been mentioned in the text that he's a bard yet. I think so.
I thought it was.
They said he was like a bard's bard or something. I'm not sure offhand. But yeah, you know, he's obviously much more than a thief in the same way, similar way, that Gord is much more than a thief at this point as well. Gord, in the early game in Dragon, I think there was the acrobat character class. And I believe that's really what Gord is. Thief became Rogue, the Rogue character class, which encompassed a lot more. I think early on that Gygax came up with the Acrobat class, and that's what you're hearing about.
It was probably in Dragon first, but I know it was in Unearthed Arcana as well.
Ah, okay. I'm not very. I wasn't very big on Unearthed Arcana, so I don't really remember what it contained. It was still early days for the game. It was first edition. So Unearthed Arcana had a lot of links directly to Greyhawk. You know, basically, when the early, you know, the first of the AD&D rule books came out, there wasn't anything else. The setting was Greyhawk. So if you look at the player's handbook, the monster manual, and even the DM's guide, you're basically looking at the background material for the Greyhawk campaign. The DM's guide has this large listing of artifacts with a little bit of history. And they have lots of little bits and pieces about the Greyhawk campaign within the write-ups of the artifacts. So yeah, you know, a lot of these things that are in these early first edition rule books are, you know, immediately, you know, are regarding things that can be added or were considered part of the Greyhawk setting.
It had the Cavalier and the Barbarian, too.
Yes, and, you know, I will just say that both those classes are things that we're going to run into in either the later in this book or at the in the next book, Artifact of Evil. I'd like to point out that right here we're on page 252, and we are now 100 pages left in the book. So we've covered over 2/3 of the story so far. Hopefully in about 2 weeks, I think we'll be finished with, you know, the commentary and the book on Saga of Old City. And I am eager to get on to Artifact of Evil. There's quite a few things I really liked in Artifact of Evil. You know, later on, some of the other books are, you know, like Sea of Death, which is a future book, is also one of my absolute favorites. All right, I'm going to restart right here. It is page 252, paragraph 3. We rode past a meadow and along a game trail that wound eastward. At a widening of this path, an arrow suddenly thunked into the bole of a tree beside Geller, and within seconds, men clad in brown and green appeared among the trees all around them. Gord reached instinctively for his sword. His friend stayed his hand with a gesture, just as one of the tall woodsmen stepped forward from the foliage and spoke. "Geller, you old bastard, that shaft came near to skewering your nose, and you never flinched," he shouted. "I trust your aim too well for flinching, stalker, but you must be getting old, too. I saw you at least 2 seconds before you loosed that arrow. What brings you to our fair forest, you miserable minion of the mighty? Hear that there was a hot young dryad new to this place. Hell no, I wanted to see if you were really as ugly as I remembered you to be," the grinning one-eyed man retorted. "And climb down off that nag and take a look with that one peeper you still got, 'cause when I get through with you, it'll be swollen shut but good." Break. Sounds like they're running into, you know, some rangers here. Doesn't necessarily mean so, but from the descriptions, the context really kind of implies ranger. At the beginning of the story, there was quite a lot of early 20th century vernacular here. It almost sounded like they were 1920s gangsters. And then for a brief time, after Gjord was imprisoned in Castle Blemmu and talking with Geller, they seem to have moved over to a kind of fantasy medieval talk. And now, again, with these forest folk, they seem to have slipped back into that early 20th century vernacular, like peeper. Peeper is from, I think, the 20th century, you know. So, you know, again, the way they use their vulgarity and the way they're talking here, a lot of this sounds, you know, doesn't sound like they've gone to the fantasy medieval again. All right, I am going to restart right here. It is page 252, the last paragraph. As Geller dismounted, Gord did the same, uncertain just what was going to happen. All that took place was a spirited round of hand-clasping and back-thumping between Geller and the one called Stalker, intermingled with more bad jokes and insults. Then Gord was introduced to the dozen woodsmen headed by Stalker, who all received him warmly. They reminded Gord of the hill folk that he and Geller had encountered earlier on their journey. But to Gord's mild amazement, these men were even bigger. One huge fellow named Chert took an instant liking to the small thief and soon was telling him all about the forest, its folk, and the community. Chert said he was not originally from this portion of the forest, having been born and raised by the hill foresters not distant. But he came to like the more civilized amenities offered in this neck of the woods, and had joined up with Stalker's boys. This information made Gord wonder what the hill foresters were like, for a rougher and tougher lot than these woodsmen he could not imagine. Towering at least 2 inches above any of the other tall woodsmen, Chert was indeed a sight to behold. His huge shoulders and brawny chest tapered to a still massive waist, which looked less substantial than it actually was, only because its girth was small in relation to his great torso. His upper body was held up by 2 legs corded with muscle, and as large as tree trunks, while his mighty arms exuded the strength that had come from wielding axe and bow since childhood. Church seemed to be totally unaware of his own stature and power, and Gord thought of him as a massive bear cub who had unknowingly grown into adulthood. A great paw clapped Gord on the shoulder, and a broad, handsome face, topped by a tangled heap of curly brown hair, smiled openly down at him. "Come on," said the giant. "Stay in my hut while you're in town. Your pal Geller will be batting the breeze with Stalker and Ned Horn all night." Gord wondered where town was, for all he saw was a closely grouped bunch of 30 or 40 rude log huts, so positioned and surrounded by growth as to make the cluster of small houses invisible from 100 yards away. Chert's own dwelling was built utilizing a partially fallen tree as the roof beam. The hut was roomier inside than it appeared to be from without, and although it was messy, the place was comfortable enough. A break. You know, there is a... I want to note especially that since we're just getting this description of Chert, that there is a Clyde Caldwell picture of him on page 255. We're on 253 currently. We're getting more about the area, about the hill foresters and these forest folk, and that, you know, a small, so far unnamed little, it would be at 40 so houses, it would be small, smaller, I think, than a town. Perhaps even smaller, well, should be about a hamlet side, or a village. You know, that's big enough for that. If you do get the chance on the Greyhawk Fiction text channel, we do have that picture of Chert, and above it we have a bit of the write-up about the acrobat class. Yes, you know, and here it's commented shirt. Really surprised. I forgot that was his described appearance there. And yet, Caldwell does do a fair job of matching his drawing to how Chert is described here by Gygax. All right. Just, you know, it should be noted that there's no frame of reference in the picture, but Chert is supposed to be the tallest of all these very tall men. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 253 and the final paragraph. His host casually dropped his huge longbow and quiver of arrows near the door, flipped his axe so that it buried itself in a log on the far wall, divested himself of his thick leather jerkin, and sprawled down on the heap of skins that served as his bed, telling Gord to round up whatever stray hides and pelts he could find, and there were plenty to be had, and relax, too. "I've got some good ale there," Chert said, indicating a small barrel near his feet, "and drinking horns are everywhere. Just find one someplace. Shake out what's ever in it and help yourself. I want you to tell me what the rest of the country is like." Gord couldn't help but like this big barbarian, yokel though he was. His quaint speech and unusual mannerisms were unaffected and honest. These virtues disarmed Gord by easy stages, being unaccustomed as he was to meeting folk who displayed such straightforward characteristics. So the young thief soon found himself talking about Greyhawk City, Ernst, his foray into the theocracy, and so on. Between frequent interruptions for a question, or some homely comparison to Chert's own limited scope of adventurous trekking, Gord managed to reveal a far amount of what he had seen and done during his life. In turn, he discovered that although rustic, the steely-eyed barbarian was no savage, but rather a bold and knowledgeable adventurer in his own realm of woodlands and wild. Their conversation was cut short by one of the men from the forest, Thorpe, calling them both to come to the council clearing. Chert jumped up, pulled on his leather jerkin, and yanked his axe loose from its resting place, and tucked the weapon into his belt. When Gord asked his young host why he was donning armor and weapons for a meeting, Chert simply told him that everyone did so at such gatherings. So Gord buckled on his own sword just as another head poked into the hut. "Hey, Chert, let's go. I'll walk with you," the newcomer said. Then he smiled at Gord and introduced himself. "You must be Geller's friend, Gord. I'm Greenleaf, your servant, sir." He smiled more broadly as he added, "Friends call me Curly," while he passed a hand over his bald pate. "Sure, Curly," the barbarian woodsman boomed in reply. "Let's all three go together. Gord's all set, and I'll just get my spear, and we can get moving." Right. I'm breaking here just to, you know, mention again that there's a nice drawing, Clyde Caldwell drawing, on the next page at 255. I really wish that Gygax had detailed Gord's travelogue at this point as he was talking to Chert. It would be interesting if he, you know, added a few bits of information we didn't have or anything, but it is just kind of glossed over right here. Just about Gord, Greyhawk City, Ernst, the theocracy, and you really don't know quite what Gord had been saying. Finally, we have here the introduction of Curly Greenleaf, who is another boon companion of Gord. All right. I'm going to restart here. It is page 254 and the last paragraph. The gathering place was about a half mile from the camp. As they walked, Curly told the two younger men that there was serious trouble brewing, but he wouldn't say more. Because it was Stalker, as leader of the community, who had the privilege and duty to bring such things before the people. Gord liked Curly right away. Though he was quite an unusual character, there was no question he was of mixed parentage. His pointed ears and bright green eyes made his elven ancestry obvious. His human heritage was evidenced by his hairless head, broad shoulders, and somewhat rotund build, plus his height of nearly 6 feet. Although the fellow appeared small next to the towering church, he was still bigger than Gord, who was actually about the same height as a mature male elf. Break. So here we have mention that, the bright green eyes are showing obvious elven ancestry. So we have, obviously, now we have two things about elves' physical description here, and then Evely, her elven heritage supposedly shows up as platinum blonde hair, so very drow-like, and violet eyes. Again, things, so there's, partly there's a surface elf that, other than the skin color, looks just like a drow. Now we have information that male drows are only, male elves should be only around 5'6 or so in height, and with violet green eyes for, now this could all be combined. It might either be violet or green. We don't know if Gygax is describing different types of elves, sylvan, high, gray. There are quite a few separate elven species right here in the campaign setting. All right, we've got a little more about Curly besides his elven heritage and some of his description and his height. So he's probably 5'10", 5'11". And of course, Chur is towering above him. So we're probably, we're looking at a very tall individual, maybe 6'6", 6'8", or even maybe a little bigger. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 256, and the third paragraph. Round Curly's neck was a gold chain from which hung a golden sun with an enameled tree upon it. When Curly noticed Gord's curiosity about it, the fellow explained that the necklace was his devotional symbol, sun and tree of life, as he called it, being representations of nature. We're druidical folk here, and I am presently serving as the spiritual counselor for this little community, he told Gord earnestly. In one of the little gold leaves forming the chain, inquired Gord, I see some are enameled green, while others are not. The druid said that this was just his particular preference, but Chur interjected that it was because he was proud of being member of the Eighth Circle, whatever that was. And if Gord could count that high, he'd find that four leaves on each side of the symbol had been colored green, plus eight curled green leaves, denoting the druid's rank, and his name, too. Break. All right, so we've got, Curly's a druid, and here Gygax introduces the ranking hierarchy of druids that is part of the AD&D game in a way that fits in with the storyline. So Curly is, he is an Eighth Circle druid. And if we're looking at kind of like a balance between Geller and Gord and Chert, then, here Gord has moved up quite a bit. At eighth level, he is just passing in the game out of the mid-range up to be a high-level character. And back then in first edition, eighth level is a fairly high level because the original game did not really go that high. And a lot of the very famous characters that come out of the Greyhawk setting at this point were not being listed as, you know, super high level characters. The game was more about adventure than like super heroics. So, you know, like lots of these characters you're going to meet, they never reach super high levels. So, wow, yeah. From the first edition AD&D, the eighth circle is 10th level of experience. So either Geller is a little more experienced than the others, or, yeah, he is definitely into the high level. And then, you know, at this point, like I said, with the game, there are only, you know, the highest level druid is only 14th level, you know, back in the first edition AD&D. So, you know, Geller is, you know, very, very powerful right here. And I just wonder if Chert and, not Geller, Greenleaf. I'm sorry, I keep saying Geller. No, Geller is undoubtedly, you know, experienced, but I don't know. Curly may be perhaps one of the highest level characters we've met so far, because 10th level, that's, you know, that's an extremely powerful character. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 256, and the second paragraph from the end. "He's a show-off, but not a bad guy," Chirk concluded, throwing a smirk in Curly's direction. They came to a place in the forest where the surrounding hills formed a small natural amphitheater. About 50 armed men were present, plus roughly the same number of women, most of them also bearing weapons, and many more children. The assemblage was quiet, and even the youngsters seemed dignified and reserved. As Gord watched, several more family groups and a few lone men drifted in from the trees that ringed the hilltops and moved to places where they sat or stood while exchanging low greetings with those around them. Break. Right here, we're getting... So wherever this little thorp, as they say, they just mentioned, is located, the terrain has changed, because... when they left Innspaw, there was 3 days of travel in the declining wooded foothills there of the Flinties, and then they were in a more flat terrain, and now this area, this thorp, this meeting place is surrounded by hills. So the terrain has changed right here. It might be indicated somewhere on a map, but so far this is an unnamed town. Not very big, as the numbers, you know, that Gord's talking about seem pretty small. But, and also it gives you an idea of how these forest folk live. The men and women are all armed. There's a large number of children here, you know, which, you know, is very good considering how dangerous the Greyhawk setting can be. You need a lot of replacements here. All right.
Did they say where they were going when they left Innspaw?
No, just that there was trouble in the Adri Forest.
Okay.
So I guess this thorp was their destination. And then from here, at least Gord will hear more of what's going on. We will hear more. I'm not sure if Geller knows already or whether he was just coming here to be told by Stalker what's going on.
Yeah, maybe to confirm a rumor or see if it's as bad as he heard. Or I mean, who knows? Yeah,
and I mean, he met with the Gnome King, and that's where he got the information about the Adri Forest. So and veered off for Innspaw. So maybe the Gnome King had received word. Everybody around here, like, you know, had been stated in yesterday, there are all these places, all these nations and states, they all seem to have a good intelligence service. You know, Boss Daly has spies, the Radikers have spies, so there is a lot of spying going on in this campaign.
Yeah, Archibald has Geller, right? I think Geller's a spy. Yeah. Or, all right.
It sounds like they have a lot of different, you know, different spying, maybe just information gathering. And obviously there's a network of at least informants around, because Geller is always seeming to meet with people, you know, to get information. I mean, not just the Gnome King, but wherever he stops, he seems to stop and meet people. I think it even mentioned that, well, no, it mentioned that he was gathering things in Innspa, but he may even have been meeting people there as well.
Reminds me of my father. Like, everywhere he goes, he seems to know someone.
Yes, my dad was the same way. He did a lot of traveling in his work. And he loved driving, and he always liked stopping at truck stops. And he was the kind of guy that, he was an engineer, but he, you know, he started out, he was a World War II vet and a grunt, you know.
And mine too.
And so he just, you know, he got along with everybody. And, you know, even as he got older, if he wasn't exactly, you know, this is like as the other younger truckers and people driving on the road there and stopping, he was like their dad, at least, you know. So you know, he was able to get, and I imagine that's kind of like Geller must have you know, those kind of characteristics, as I imagine him.
Yeah, he's got a vast network of contacts.
Yeah, you know, and Gygax was only, you know, Gygax wasn't my parents' generation. He was like some of my cousins, my sister, you know, was more that generation. And
yeah, he was 40s, right, I think?
When this was going on. He was born in the
40s, I think.
Or
later.
I don't know. He might have been born in the late 40s. I don't know offhand.
Yeah, my dad was born in 23, and my mom was born in 30. So I think Gary's a little older than that.
Yeah, my dad was 24, and my mom was in 1930.
Yeah. Hey, that's pretty close. Yeah, my father was in Italy in World War II.
Mine was, you know, first went over. He joined right after D-Day. His whole class marched down.
Yeah, they all did.
Yeah, they got a picture of him and the whole high school class marching down to enlist. Yeah,
they didn't go to senior week. They went to fight in Europe.
Yeah, and my dad was, you know, in training till the invasion. So, you know, he was in the military from 41 to, you know, to the end. But you know, here I digress, but
Anyway, my point was that there's a place on the map close to Innspa called Druid's Well. It looks like it's in the middle of a heavily forested region. Maybe that's where they are. I'm just guessing.
That might be it. Although maybe something that we'll find out here, or something that is actually in the second edition material.
Yeah, and I haven't read ahead at this point. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like that myself. I don't know about the other listeners, but I really enjoy discovering stuff that I should remember after so many readings.
And sometimes I think my questions are a little bit better if I read, like, just a little bit ahead. But
yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. Let me restart. It is page 257, paragraph 1. Curly took his leave of Gord and Chert and headed for a cleared place at the bottom of the bowl-shaped dell where both Stalker and Geller already stood. In a moment, these two were joined by the druid, a tall, handsome woman clad in a dark green robe who appeared to be in her mid-30s. Gord asked Chert who she was. The barbarian replied that she was some sort of spellbinder or something, and he didn't trust her much. After looking slowly around the circumference of the dale, the leader of the community began speaking. Stalker's deep voice carried well, even though he was not shouting. The place was formed such that even those near the top of the low hillsides could hear him clearly. He simply announced that the gathering was summoned so that all could hear the message of Geller, whom he referred to as an old and trusted friend of the folk who dwelled in Adry Forest. Stalker affirmed, for the sake of those who did not know Geller, that they could rely upon him for candor and truth. Break. So it is Geller who knows what's going on, and he's going has informed Stalker, rather than the other way around. We get a little bit about this community, little natural amphitheater here. So that definitely does add, it's outside of town, but it definitely does add to the locale information right here.
And he doesn't like the woman, which is growth for him.
Yeah, Gord is a love at first sight kind of guy. Very much Romeo here. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 257. Paragraph 3. Free folk of Adry are not much concerned with the affairs of kings and princes. This I know, began Geller. Erdi or Nirond are not masters you wish to serve. Neither is desirable, so you pit one against the other, and thus remain free of both, as well Relmord and Roxas understand. There is a difference between the two thrones, though, and you are as able as I to state it. Nirond and her allies think that their rule would be just and fair, while the Overking of Erdi cares nothing for such ethical considerations, desiring only tyrannical power. There were a few murmurs from the listeners. Several called out agreement, but noted that even a well-meaning oppressor is still nothing more than a despot. Do not mistake my purpose, Geller cried in reply. I'm not here to apologize for any crown, nor to urge acceptance of any yoke. You are woodsmen, and you bend your knee to no monarch. I serve many crowns, but I also desire nothing less than the right of liberty, which you now hold, and your continued freedom. That is why I stand before you now. Life and liberty are threatened, and it is my duty to give warning. This is a grave matter, and you must decide what course you will follow, Geller said somberly. The facts are these. What was mistaken for merely an ambitious scheme to create a petty new kingdom to the north is actually a machination of Ivid. At the mention of the Overking's name, several of the audience spat. One-eyed speaker went on without comment. My own initial assessment of the situation was mistaken, and I have been party to this, unwittingly, until now. Nirondel army with many auxiliary forces is even now assembling to meet in the Blumoo Hills. King Archibald himself will lead the force, and its purpose is to finish the destruction of the humanoid state that has ensconced itself in Bone Marsh. Secure the new fief for Nirond, and establish a strong frontier between that state and the advancing Radicans. Such in itself is of little interest to the free folk of Adry, Geller continued, as more scattered mutterings arose from the crowd. But there is more to the story than first seems. Force in the Blemu Hills now gives the Overking a target. If he can defeat the Nirondel hosts there, Erdi would regain the whole of her lost northern frontier, from the Flinty Hills to the mountains that guard Radic's southern border. Worse still, if the advancing Nirondel army is caught in a cauldron between the Harp River and the Teaser Torrent with Eridian forces to the south, and east, and savage tribes of humanoids to the north, then Archibald is between mountain and murder. He and a few could certainly make good an escape, but the rest would die by the thousands, unable to retreat, and opposed by overwhelming numbers of foemen. Oh, the battle would be bloody on both sides, and the cost to the Malachite throne high. But what cares the Overking for soldiers? The slaughter of the Nirondel army and its allied divisions would cripple the capacity of Archibald. even with help from the Prelacy of Almor to defend his eastern borders, the Overking's frontier would leap westward in a rush, and all of the Adri Forest would be within the Great Kingdom once again. Ivid's heavy hand would grasp the lands from the Flinty Hills to that branch of the Harp River known as the Lyr. Perhaps Chathold would even fall. Perhaps not. Almor would be hard-pressed to retain its lands east of the Harp. You know, later on, after the Gygax era, they did the Greyhawk Wars box set, which was mostly a war game and a little bit of lore, but it was also a game changer where, you know, the very makeup of the setting was heavily altered. And you can see here, as well as some articles in Dragon Magazine, by Gygax, that there were ideas of developing warfare going on, and looking at the Bandit Kingdoms, which had five kingdoms taken over by two by the Hierarchs, two by the Tenna, and one by the Pale, that, you know, there has been, you know, warfare continuously going on, you know, or at least previously going on in the setting. So you can see here where some of the ideas that led up to that Greyhawk Wars box set were developing. The only difference is that Gygax, you know, did not seem to be taking them in quite the direction that was ended up being used in Greyhawk Wars. I am a big Gygaxian. I like Gygax's work. I like his ideas and how he presented things. But even I don't necessarily follow exactly what was good for his campaign. You know, like, I like having Spine Castle and the lands around be wild. I really would not want to take my campaign and have the humanoids defeated. I like having Nyrond and Almor, and I would not enjoy a campaign which changed those so radically that they were either wiped out or subservient again to the Great Kingdom. Not my style, but, you know, everything's to different people's taste. And here in Gygax's Greyhawk literary campaign, which, you know, is different from his home campaign, here we see him moving into the realm of open warfare.
It's nice to see the Adri Wild too.
Yeah, you know, it's really been this travelogue business, like, you know, Chert wanted to hear. I love hearing about. I love that he is moving around the Flaness, and just we are gaining a little insight and a little view and atmosphere of all these different places. Now we have, you know, Geller speaking, and Geller is talking about, you know, here these woodsmen, these forest folk, are free, and how they are in danger of either Nyrond's supposedly goodwill or the Overking's vaunting tyrannical ambition, and they don't like either. They want to remain free.
Yeah, we only get a couple paragraphs in the folio, and this is fleshing it out a little bit. I think it's nice.
It's. That's why even what might seem inconsequential, that we can take apart and examine it and see how it fills out the way the campaign is run, the way that the rule system works. There's just so much in a novel, which is why it's kind of a shame that there weren't a series of novels being written about Greyhawk that were decent. And had somebody who at least understood the game and the lore. The quality of the writing doesn't need to be a first-rate dramatic, novel, or, you know, narrative. It needs to have, you know, a decent expansion of the lore and life breathed into it, and that's what makes these Gygax Gord novels so special. He really did breathe life into the setting, more so than anything else I've seen from any of the editions.
Yep, it's really good stuff. Hey, I'm going to head out a little bit early tonight.
Sure. Well, we're at 6:59, so okay. Oh,
a minute.
Night.
Good night.
See you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, to just end up here, we do get, you know, more information about what is going on and the influences and where this fighting is going to take place. Some information about Almor and its relation to Nyrond. You know, right here, this is the, you know, this is some, you know, very good background. The desires of Archibald and what he wants to do with the Bone March. We end up with, you know, we end up with a little more location that they're, where in the along the Harp River that they the Leer that they want to take. So again, this is, you know, this is good background information and campaign source information. All right, I am going to end this. It is page 258, this was recording number 33. July 13th, 2021. I'm going to call Craig here, our recording bot, and end this for tonight.